Good morning, and welcome to Frankly Speaking. Today we'll be discussing the draft, registration, and your rights. I'm Joan Ziemba for George Mason University. To date, about 7 million young men born between 1960 and 1964 have registered for the draft in compliance with the law. Close to 1 million have not. Last month, the government pledged to prosecute those who have failed to register. A bill before the United States Congress proposes all those not in compliance be stripped of any federal benefits. A Virginia bill, brought before committee and defeated, proposed that young men who have not registered not be allowed to enroll in a state university. Other states are introducing similar bills. The reinstatement of the draft and the attendant legal and societal complications has become an emotional and ideological issue once again.
He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more.
Many question the need for and legalities of military conscription in a time of peace. With us today to discuss the legal and technical aspects of the draft and registration are Washington, D.C. attorney Barry Lynn and David Kubrick, associate professor at George Mason University. Barry, with the over 800,000 young men who failed to register, how can the government prosecute these people?
Really, this is the biggest law enforcement crisis in modern American history. Not since Prohibition have 800,000 or 900,000 people violated a federal law. There's no way that the government will be able to prosecute all of these individuals, so they will choose to prosecute just a few, try to make examples of them, and therefore frighten other people into registering. My sense is it may have precisely the opposite effect. If they do prosecute 20 or 30 people, it may drive other non-registrants further and further underground, and they may not be able to achieve anything like a fair number of registrants. The director of Selective Service last week indicated that if they did not reach a 98% compliance, you could not have a fair draft. Well, with over 900,000 non-registrants out there, they're nowhere close to 98% of compliance, and the draft would be unfair, even by the admission of the Director of Selective Service himself.
I think compliance at this point is somewhere around 70%, isn't it?
The compliance now varies between about 77% and 94%. There are, of course, a whole other category of people who did register for the draft initially, but who then moved and failed to notify the Selective Service of their whereabouts. So not only do we have 900,000 non-registrants, but by Selective Service's own figures, perhaps 1 million people whose whereabouts are now effectively unknown.
What are the costs to the taxpayers in prosecuting a case like this?
Every case that is prosecuted that results in even a modest jail term, according to the Justice Department, would cost approximately $25,000. This means that in FBI investigation time and general court costs, $25,000 per prosecution.
How will the government track those that have, say, registered and moved or have not registered at all? There was a Privacy Act in 1974 preventing Selective Service from using Social Security or other government records.
Well, after nearly 2 years of draft registration as a federal program, they have identified exactly 183 non-registrants. And all of those people are persons who sent a letter to the Department of Justice or to Selective Service telling them that they were non-registrants and that they planned to continue to be so, and then gave their moral, political, religious reasons for failing to register. Self-report is all they've got at this point. However, they also have a somewhat more sophisticated system possible in that they could use Social Security Administration lists of names and addresses, matching those with the names and addresses of the people who did register for the draft.
Why is there a draft right now? Why is there registration for a draft? This is peacetime. Is this the first peacetime draft registration we've had?
Well, technically, there have been peacetime registrations in the past. Frankly, the reasons for this registration are quite unclear. It's not at all apparent that this is anything that gains as much in terms of military preparedness, perhaps a few weeks at most in the event of a national emergency. Effectively, we should be spending money on making the all-volunteer force a successful and fair and at a reasonable size. It's growing way out of proportion right now. We have over 2,080,000 persons on active duty. We have a selected reserve and National Guard of over 800,000 persons, an individual ready reserve. These are the people who would be the early battlefield casualty replacements in the event of a major war. That now numbers 420,000 persons. The reserves, therefore, have grown over 120,000 in the last few years. It's getting bigger, probably bigger than we need right now. There's certainly no need for a draft right now. In terms of comparability, the draft of the 1970s was getting us a quality of people that was in many years lower than the quality of people who are now volunteering for military service in the all-volunteer force.
David, you resisted the draft in the 60s. Did you resist that in terms of a conscientious objector?
Yes, in the Vietnam draft, I think there were two types of conscientious objectors. One, and by far the largest category, applied for conscientious objection. In fact, by the end of the Vietnam draft, according to Selective Service own figures, over 50% of the registrants were applying for conscientious objection. Over 20% of them were receiving it. Another group felt that the draft was also unfair. They were conscientiously opposed, not only to fighting in Vietnam, but also to a draft that was very unfair, drafting mainly the poor and giving deferments and exemptions to the middle and upper classes. I sided with those who also opposed the draft, and so I returned my draft cards. I had a student deferment. I sent one draft card to the Justice Department and one back to my draft board.
What are some of the deferments that this draft will have? Will they differ from the draft of the 60s?
At least on paper, this draft differs from the 60s draft. The 60s draft gave many deferments and exemptions to students and some for occupational reasons. This time around, there'll be essentially five types of deferments or exemptions. And those are very limited. The first of these would be 2D and 4D for the registrant who is a ministerial student or a minister. The second exemption, 4F, would be for registrants who are not qualified for medical, mental, or moral reasons. The third exemption, 4G, would be for the registrant who is a sole surviving son. Then there would be an exemption also for hardship, for someone who has a dependent for whom he provides essential physical or psychological support. And finally, there would be the conscientious objector deferment or exemption.
You know, there's a lot of talk about the fact that this draft, according to Selective Service, is fairer than it was before. But there's something very odd about the phrase of a fair draft. A fair draft is a lot like a jackalope. It's largely a mythological figure. If you have the money, the time, and the savvy to really get into this system and use it to your advantage, you will be able to get a far better chance of getting out of the system than if you're not very wealthy or you don't have good connections into the community to talk to people about your medical problems or possible medical problems, or your conscientious objection to war. These are not objective deferments, conscientious objection, hardship, medical deferments. These are very subjective. If you've got the time, the money, the savvy to go see three psychiatrists, I can guarantee you that one of them will be able, in using perfectly good medical judgment and in all medical integrity, be able to say that you are mentally unfit for service. Most people don't have the money to see three psychiatrists. They don't even know where to find the first one. The system is still unfair. The system will still hurt people who are poor or who don't have access to power and influence. information. It's no fairer now than it was during the Vietnam-era draft, in spite of what Selective Service and the President tells us.
There are a number of bills that are somewhat discriminatory towards non-registrants, towards men in general, since women aren't involved in the draft. One is in Virginia and one is in the United States Congress. Could you tell us a little bit about those?
These laws would like to punish a person for failing to register for the draft by depriving him of all federal benefits, in the case of the Congressional Act, depriving them of any chance of getting a federal job as well. What this really means is that without a conviction, just on the word of Selective Service that a person is a non-registrant, that person would be deprived of all federal benefits. I think this is clearly unconstitutional. It violates the basic principle of due process of law that requires you to have a hearing, that requires you to have notice of what you're about to have taken away from you. I think it is close to something called a bill of attainder, which is prohibited by the Constitution. A bill of attainder is when the Congress tries to punish a class of people outside the criminal justice system. We have laws on the books that say you can spend up to 5 years in a federal penitentiary and pay a $10,000 fine if convicted of failing to register for the draft. And if the government wishes to pursue this draft registration, it's got a criminal channel to use. It should not use these civil sanctions, these quasi-criminal sanctions, as have been suggested in both Virginia, where I hope it has finally been defeated, or at the federal level.
Between 8 and 10 years ago, the draft board storefronts just kind of disappeared all over America. What is the plan at this point? Do you know? Will young men continue to register through their post offices, or will draft boards be reestablished?
The registration will continue to occur at the post offices, but there have now been chosen members for approximately 10,000 local draft boards, one in each county or similar subdivision around the United States. Later in March and in April, there will be training sessions for the persons who were selected as local draft board members. These training sessions will last only a day and a half and will certainly not adequately prepare anyone to make the very difficult kinds of decisions that draft board members will make.
If I may, I'd like to follow up on Barry's comment about conscientious objection. One of the interesting things that did happen during Vietnam was that practically all the mainline denominations not only came out in much stronger support of conscientious objection than any time in the past, but also came out in support of people who refused to fight in this war, whether or not they were recognized by Selective Service as conscientious objectors. So I think that perhaps for the first time in the history of Christianity, the American churches took an important step toward living up to the primary Judeo-Christian teaching about military service, namely that it's okay to fight in just wars, but that it's immoral, it's murder or collaboration in murder to fight in unjust wars. And the Vietnam War was considered by most of our best public theologians to be an unjust war. This time, Selective Service is trying to make conscientious objection much harder to get. And so if parents and educators and ministers want young men to make thoughtful, conscientious decisions about military service, then they must set out about creating the appropriate means. For instance, discussions in the home and educational units, in the schools and churches. Under the new regulations, it's only this type of advanced planning that will allow young men who are not members of traditional peace churches, such as the Quakers, the Mennonites, and the Brethren, to be recognized as conscientious objectors.
Thank you both. I'm afraid we're out of time. We've been talking with Barry Lynn and David Kubrick. For more information regarding your legal responsibilities concerning the draft, call the National Headquarters of Selective Service 724-0790. For more information regarding your legal rights concerning the draft, call the National Interreligious Service Board for Conscientious Objectors, 393-4868. You've been listening to Frankly Speaking, a public service program produced by George Mason University, production coordinator Pat Ping. For more information about our guests or this program, please call area code 323-2138. I'm Joan Ziemba for the State University in Northern Virginia. Thank you for listening.